Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today's May 27th. It's 5 minutes after 9 a.m. Present today, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. Senator Olson is weathered out at the present time. We have one item today for consideration of the committee for the rest of the week or the rest of the month, whichever may happen, which is Senate Bill 2001, the gas line, a volumetric tax, AGDC and RCA. We've invited Mr. Nicholas Fulford of Gaffney Klein. We plan on starting with some of the basics of mega projects and this project that's proposed. So I didn't bring forward Nicholas Fulford to the committee to identify himself and give us the presentation. Before we start, we do have in the audience, we're joined by Senator Bjorgman, and I think Senator Myers are in the audience as well.
Okay. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, committee members. For the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford, and I'm Senior Director of Gas and LNG at Gaffney Klein. So, just before we start, normally we have a basis of opinion slide, which I seem to have omitted, but I wanted to briefly mention that Gaffney Klein is a wholly owned subsidiary, indirectly owned subsidiary of Baker Hughes, who manufacture LNG equipment globally. You'll have noticed that Baker Hughes are one of the supply partners for Glenfarne. So I wanted to make it abundantly clear that Gaffney Klein's consulting activities are completely ring-fenced from the activities of Baker Hughes, and that only certain named individuals work on the project with the legislature, so there's no crossover at all. So I just wanted to make that point, both for the committee and for the general public. So perhaps by way of introduction, obviously now Gaffney Klein has been providing input to the state for probably over 20 years, and my own involvement with the state and the LNG project goes back to the days of Senator Parnell and what was known as Senate Bill 138 at that time. And one of the things I wanted to talk about today is some of the changes that have evolved over the years and some of the differences between the project that we're looking at today and that one. So I think one of the helpful points to point out is back in 2014-15, one of the major elements that I was working on personally was LNG property tax. At the time, there was an entity called the Municipal Advisory Gas Project Review Board, and I worked alongside many of the various mayors and the borough officials at the time. So as we approach the discussions over the next few days and weeks, it's perhaps worth acknowledging that the question of property tax for LNG has been something that has been high up on the agenda for the LNG project for some time. I think there are three elements of property tax which have created that degree of attention. One is the magnitude. You know, it's a relatively high tax for the project to bear. The second is that it affects the near-term economics of the project, which from a developer point of view is particularly troublesome. And the third element, of course, is that as you look at projecting property tax going forwards, because the taxable value of the assets can change, then that means the tax changes as well. So from a fiscal stability point of view, from being able to look forward and forecast, you know, that's another feature. So really it's those three features which have led to really all the debate and dialogue over the last few years, and ones that we can perhaps talk about a little bit today. So the next point I wanted to make by way of introduction is that I've probably worked personally on dozens of LNG projects around the world, and some of those in Texas, Louisiana, you know, they're very straightforward. Those states host dozens of LNG projects. They make very little difference to the state economy. But then you get other host nations and states where, you know, the effect of the project on the state economy is transformative, and Alaska is very definitely in that category. And then you layer in the particular, you know, characteristics of the Alaska Constitution, where, you know, one of the duties of this committee is to ensure that the state resources are appropriately developed and revenue is generated in the interests of the citizens. That adds another degree of due diligence that's required. So in that kind of environment, with a transformative project with a very clear constitutional requirement, the debate and the dialogue around taxation, government take, and so forth, it does take a long time. And so insofar as it's taken a lot of dialogue here in Alaska, it's not untypical. You know, I could point to many other projects around the world where a similar kind of process has happened. And actually, you know, British Columbia, just south of us, is probably a good example of where it probably took the provincial government maybe 5 years to finally reach an accommodation with the developers of LNG Canada, along with the federal government. So, you know, you could argue the 5 years has been ticking for a while in Alaska, but nevertheless, you know, I think what you're seeing here and the challenges and the diligence that's gone into property taxes is quite anticipated. The second project, which I think helps to put today's remarks in context, is that today the Alaska LNG project in its entirety is probably the largest gas infrastructure project in consideration. The amount of capital involved, the investment, the flow of revenues, they're on a kind of a giant scale. And so it puts the project on a similar level to TAPS, for example, you know, where, you know, TAPS became a kind of a landmark project for the state, as this would if it were to go ahead. So it's worth remembering that this is an extremely ambitious project, but nevertheless one with huge benefits if it were to go forward. Thirdly, I think, again, from my experience looking at formative LNG projects like this, I can't remember any example where an LNG project has been so profitable from the outset that it's had a kind of a plain sailing through to FID. Typically, getting these projects over the line to start with is the most difficult thing. Once you've built them, they tend to perform a little better than the specification. They can be modified, improved. And, you know, again, you look at LNG Canada, they're just considering a major expansion of the plant. So once you get them moving, that's when the economics really start to improve. And, of course, you know, over the years when the debt gets paid off and so forth, the cash flow from these projects is absolutely immense and, you know, it can be obviously very transformative for the host nation. Finally, the feature that I wrote about in the report, which was published last December, discusses fiscal stability. And in in some jurisdictions, there is such a thing as a fiscal stability agreement, a contractual agreement between the LNG developers and the government. Some of them contain a kind of a balancing clause such that if taxes change, there's some other compensation that takes place. Clearly, we're not in that in that category in Alaska. But nonetheless, you know, with the amount of capital deployed and with the reliance on years of revenues, fiscal stability is a key feature which will be important in any outcomes that you consider. So moving on to today's agenda, I have this divided into a number of areas. We can pause as appropriate and come back to it if necessary. But I wanted to start with a little bit of scene setting just to for the committee and for the public to understand the scale of the project and really its context in terms of both the state and globally. The next thing I wanted to do was to discuss what is still existing legislation, Senate Bill 138, which put in place really the framework for the original LNG project some 10, 12 years ago, and some of the differences that we're seeing today with the Glen Farm project. I wanted to also touch on what I've called other sources of economic benefit. These relate mainly to the gas treatment plant and the potential for tax credits on the CO2. And, you know, they also relate to, you know, other features like federal loan guarantees. Then I wanted to move on and talk about the LNG market and the competitiveness of the project, and then think about the phase one gas line considerations, and finally competition from Canada, which I think is probably one of the areas where you're going to see most competition in terms of capital and investment.
Mr. Fulford, if you have time, after all of that, I wonder if you might comment upon the times that we're living in, which is the war, and what, if anything, does that have as an impact on this project?
Thank you, Chairman, and that's a very timely remark. I think
at the end of your agenda.
I see. I will certainly cover that.
Thank you.
But it's a very valid comment for sure. So as we think about the project as a whole, it's as it's planned, it's 20 million tons per annum of LNG. That's out of a global market today of about 400. It's actually a billion MMBTUs. It's my British upbringing is mistyping it as therms. So it's a billion MMBTUs per annum, which makes some of the maths a lot easier in terms of the revenues and the money. So if you multiply a billion MMBTUs by what was the prevailing price in Asia before the conflict in the Middle East, you get about $11 billion per annum of revenue. The other interesting feature, I think, which you know perhaps puts into context just how important this is for the state, if you look at the forecasted LNG revenues in the context of the Alaskan economy, it's about a 20% ratio of revenues to current GDP. If you look at Texas, for example, it's less than 0.5%. And you know, if you look at other jurisdictions, the LNG Canada project boosted the BC economy by 3%, with estimated provincial revenues of $78 billion by the 2060s. And certainly in their case, the assessment is that it created some 71,000 jobs. Moving on to the other end of the scale, the resource, we have 35 trillion cubic feet of proven gas up on the North Slope, much of which has been produced already and reinjected. And even that multiplied by our $11 price, just as an example, you get to about $400 billion worth of gas once it's delivered. And then if you look at the other gas on the slope, even a connection into Arctic Canada, what you see is that there are, you know, years' worth of relatively low-cost gas which could come through this plant ultimately. So some estimates talk about 200 trillion cubic feet of gas in that region, which would be the equivalent of $2 trillion when it's delivered. So really the volumes, the numbers, they're really quite eye-watering. But to get there obviously requires a huge investment, as we've discussed. The other feature which sets the Alaska LNG project apart is the emphasis on capital investment. Because unlike the Gulf Coast projects, which involve smaller capital investment but higher operating costs, for example, gas purchase and shipping, Alaska is quite the opposite. And although it's a gas project, it's almost easier to look at it as if it were a toll road or an airport or some kind of infrastructure project, because most of the value for AKLNG is going to be in that midstream, in the processing plant, the pipeline, and the liquefaction. Once you've put those facilities in, the running costs of the project, if you like, are relatively low. And, you know, you'll often read in the press that, you know, Alaska LNG is too expensive. It's, you know, it's never going to fly because of that. In actual fact, I think, as you'll see later on in the presentation, you know, the economics are perfectly feasible under certain conditions. It's just that the emphasis is on the upfront capital as opposed to the money required to make the project run. So just to illustrate the preponderance of capital in the project, I put together this chart based on some generic assumptions. But what you see here is that out of the delivered price to Asia, for Alaska, probably about 80 to 90% certainly of that value as in the delivered gas is completely attributable to the upfront capital investment. For the Gulf Coast, it's about a third. So that shows, I think, just how much of an infrastructure project this is, which revolves around, you know, initial very large outlays of capital and steady revenue to pay for it. LNG Canada sits somewhere in the middle, about 75%. So on this slide, I started talking about the differences between Senate Bill 138 and the current structure. So there are three typical forms of an LNG project in terms of the commercial structure. I've chosen two of them to illustrate here. One is what's called a fully integrated LNG project, which typically means that the equity investment in the upstream and in the production of the gas remains constant all the way through the value chain down to the ships. And certainly for an equity marketing type of arrangement, for every MMBTU that a particular producer puts on the ship, it would turn into a cargo further down the road. So everything is kind of streamlined and aligned. And what this means is that the number of commercial interfaces and the number of negotiations that have to take place are considerably reduced. And that was the project that existed back in 2014-15 with ConocoPhillips, BP in those days, ExxonMobil, and the state, all having a similar equity share in the project right the way through from the wellhead down to the LNG ships. The project that we have in front of us today with Glenfarne is what's called a merchant structure. In that case, the investors in the LNG project, in the infrastructure, the liquefaction, are different from the investors in the upstream. And what that means is that there's a gas purchase agreement, which involves the production of the gas and the sales to the LNG project. So so that creates a major interface, which obviously requires considerable negotiation and discussion to make it work appropriately. The other feature, which is a little different, or can be, is the way in which the LNG is sold. I think under the current project, the sales mechanism is simply a sale to third parties, creditworthy third parties. And obviously there are a number of Asian LNG buyers who've already indicated interest in the project. The third mechanism just briefly discussed is a tolling mechanism, which hasn't been raised in the current context, but it is quite a common mechanism whereby the infrastructure owner, or the liquefaction company, charges a toll. It's a fixed toll, usually has inflation involved, but it's enough to cover off the capital investment. So that's a structure which is used quite frequently on the Gulf Coast for people who simply want to buy gas, liquefy it, and then deal with the LNG on the other end.
Senator Stedman.
Are you done with this slide?
Yes.
Okay, before we go to that slide, that integrated structure you talked about, I think for the state's 25% share, that included our royalties plus a gas tax to create that 25% alignment with the three major producers in that project, which seems to be quite dissimilar from the merchant structure or this tolling structure that you just mentioned. Could you help us with that?
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. That's an excellent point, in that the original 25% entitlement to equity, I think it was 25 plus or minus, depending on how things turned out, was really a direct approximation of the value of the royalty and taxes gas that would have applied to the upstream. And so that's really the spark which kind of led to this concept of the integrated structure. So obviously the state continues to have options in terms of royalty in kind and taxes gas, but that automatic sort of flow of the state's entitlement to gas all the way through the chain, I think, is not present in this current scheme, even though as a kind of a continuation from the concept which did exist through AGDC, the state continues to have, obviously, this 25% equity. But the linkage between the state's 25% equity and the taxes, gas, royalty, and kind concept, I think, is not present in this project.
So when you're looking at Senate Bill 138, I think Senator Olson, Senator Stedman, and myself were at this table when that whole concept was presented into legislation, and we understood the involvement of the producers. So can you comment upon the involvement of the producers in the merchant structure, or are you going to hit on that later?
Thank you, Chair. And I can comment briefly now. I was going to return to it also.
Okay.
But
yes. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I'm wondering, the merchant structure, the original proposal was producers on the slope looking at, if we've got gas, we want to send it south. You described what we're looking at now as more of a highway, is a phrase I think you use. So are you seeing this as a highway with kind of multiple on-ramps, or is the story still all about production on the slope? I was wondering, as you were talking about the potential, if you were taking into account other potential basins that might produce gas along the general route. So if we picture the pipeline as, you know, going from point to point, and we've talked in other committees about takeoff points, I'm just wondering if there's been any look at other input points from other potential areas of production throughout the state.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman, and through the chair. Again, it's a highly relevant question in the sense that although the merchant structure arguably has some additional complication, one of the benefits is that it's once you form the project, it is easier to start to include gas input from other sources. One or two of the Australian projects have done this where they've started the project using, you know, a certain gas field, and they've extended it by adding additional gas production areas. So the merchant structure does have that advantage that it's easier then to add additional gas.
Senator Kaufman?
So I think it was, I'm not sure the numbering system here, I think it was slide 4 where you were talking about the total potential volume. Was that including, I made a little map just preparing for today, so like the Denana Basin, of course the federal offshore, Yukon Flats over in Canada, the Susitna Basin, West Susitna, Cook Inlet, and potentially, who knows, even Bristol Bay as part of the gas supply continuum we could create with this system.
Yes, Senator, through the chair. One of the main considerations in terms of where this gas comes from will be the oil environment. One of the reasons that, for example, that Qatar is so successful as an LNG producer is that the liquids that come with that gas, the condensate, is so valuable that the gas is almost a waste product, that the value of the gas or the cost of the gas is almost zero, which is why essentially Qatar remains, even now, the sort of base supply for global markets. One of the key attributes which makes the Alaska LNG project work is that in spite of this very, very high capital investment, the cost of the gas is potentially very low indeed in the same way. And the reason it's low is because it's associated gas. It certainly for Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, a lot of the infrastructure is already there because of the liquids. So as you think about that build-out, the key feature which will determine which of those areas might get developed and included will be a low cost of gas, which most probably will be linked with some kind of liquids development.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulford, thinking back to previous attempts, and there have been a lot, in the past, the legislature spent a lot of time on the potential for expansion, whether that's looping, compression, feeder lines. And the question of who pays, certainly in the past with producer-owned projects, there's been a concern about access and whether the cost of expansion can be a barrier to access. In the project before us, should we be concerned about that? Should we be insisting on a rolled-in rate structure, which was, I think, a part of AGEA before I think you were involved in Alaska's work, but how ought we be thinking about that with the project proposal before us today?
Thank you, Senator, and through the chair. Expansion, some features of expansion are usually dealt with in the formative stages of the project in terms of options to either participate or not in expansion and the capital cost that goes with that. So this might be an important, you know, consideration as you consider this project, partly because expansion and essentially greater capital efficiency by pushing more gas and more LNG through those same facilities, that's one of the paths that will lead to a much more profitable project and potentially higher cash flows for the state. So expansion usually does get considered at an early stage so that at least there's an outline framework that is in place as expansion then gets considered. And it's perhaps something to discuss with AGDC and the project developers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So again, just remaining with this theme of Senate Bill 138, I think we probably talked about quite a few of the features that relate to this slide. But perhaps the key one, which I'll come back to, is this question of the value transfer from the midstream to the upstream. Depending on how that gas supply agreement is structured, there could be quite significant flows of revenue between the gas processing plant, the transmission line, and the liquefaction, and the upstream. Now, obviously, as I think this committee is very well aware, the taxation mechanisms that Alaska has for the upstream are very different from the ones that would apply to the downstream. So one of the considerations here is that with this ebb and flow of value between the upstream and the midstream, what the tax consequences are and what considerations and what policy might be needed to address that. So I think that's the main point here, which I go on and discuss in more detail. So the other feature I wanted to talk about in terms of the differences and where we are today is that of disclosures and confidentiality. Again, if you look at the list on the right-hand side for Senate Bill 138, because it was an integrated project, there was no need for an explicit gas supply agreement. There would have been net back calculations, but they'd have been more of an internal accounting thing. The equity structure of the project was set from day one, and the way the LNG was sold was effectively going to be in equity proportions. So you've got these three major areas of agreement, contractual agreements, which were effectively dealt with at the start. With the Glenfarne AGDC framework, as we've discussed, and as has been reported in the media, I think, that there's a dialogue going on between Glenfarne and the major producers on the slope. So that requires considerable negotiation. I've heard from their testimony that Glenfarne are looking at additional equity participants, so they'll be discussing equity and the value of it with those. And then, of course, we have the LNG sales agreements. So certainly for the first two of those, the upstream supply agreement and the equity participation, the economics of the project in a negotiating environment are very, very tightly held, because clearly in that commercial back and forth, whether it's around equity or upstream supply, the understanding of the broad economic basis of the project is a key feature. So unlike in SB 138, where there was a considerable degree of transparency between ExxonMobil as the developer then, you know, the state and other entities, with the current arrangement, it's not surprising, frankly, that there is some degree of concern over confidentiality, capital costs, and so forth. So this is a feature which is often encountered in LNG projects of this sort. And I've put a few examples on this next page in terms of how people have dealt with that. So,
Senator Stedman.
Back on a previous slide, I think we're kind of glossing over the scale, because as I recall that the previous framework of 138, those companies had significant balance sheets to put on the table. But one in particular, ConocoPhillips, as I recall, was concerned that that could be a company-ending event if it was to go south. The project was so big. And there was obviously concern from the other BP and Exxon, the magnitude, but they had, all three of them had significant balance sheets. In this case, Glenfarne doesn't. They couldn't finance this thing if they had to by themselves. So I think we're the scale difference between the previous three participants under 138, including the state with its financial assets and its taxing authority, far eclipses the structure of Glenfarne.
Thank you, Senator, and through the chair. That's an excellent point, and it focuses perhaps on the last one on this slide, which is the equity participation. And as you say, looking at the sort of basic financial framework and the companies involved, it is clear that one or more companies with a very significant balance sheet would have to enter the project with equity in order for it to get across the finish line. Typically, that can include producers, or it could be major buyers. I mean, for example, you know, JERA in Japan, who've signed up, at least in principle, for some volumes. POSCO, conceivably, from Korea. PTT in Thailand. These are all companies who typically will take equity in projects where they're sourcing gas. So there's an array of companies that are AAA credit entities with very strong balance sheets who could enter, but as yet there's no visibility on who they might be and under what terms they might enter the project. But it is one of the key differences.
Senator Stedman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, because and we'll get into this later, the scale of what we're dealing with, but we could be looking at in excess of 10 or 15 billion in equity. So this is not an insignificant dollar amount. So I think at some point when we get into this over the next several days, we need to look at that, Mr. Chairman, and then get into more discussion on the dilution issue, the equity dilution issue, which the state would be facing as a residual owner right now at 25%, with no equity participation coming into the project yet from a third party.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I won't hesitate long on this page. There's a lot of detail on it, but really this is a summary of other LNG projects that have found themselves in a similar situation to yourselves, that you're being asked to determine fiscal policy and potentially change tax rates without, at this point, full visibility into the project economics and so forth. So there are different approaches that have been used, but many of them use some kind of common economic tool to evaluate the project. And in fact, I know you've had a lot of analysis done by Department of Revenue that Mr. Stickle has presented. And I believe that model that is currently hosted by Department of Revenue is a derivation of the open book economic model that was, in fact, used in the days of Senate Bill 138. So in that sense, you already have a tool readily available, which has been well scrubbed, well audited. And really focusing on that with an appropriate number of counterparties might be the way to find your way through some of these economics. But clearly, confidentiality is often raised and indeed is an issue. And that was one of the things that was dealt with under SB 138, with a list of individuals who were authorized to look at the economics. Again, maybe some lessons to be learned for the current situation.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
So I want to return briefly then to this question of the upstream gas contract, because the way in which it's framed, as I say, will have a significant impact on the way the tax flows occur. And certainly in the testimony and in the media and so forth, what you typically see is a reference to a base price. So is it going to be a dollar? Is it going to be a dollar 50? That's typically the sort of rhetoric that goes with it. The reality is, of course, that it won't be a fixed price. There'll be some kind of indexation applied to the price. One common way of indexing gas is to use oil. So that's, you know, potentially one of the mechanisms that could be used to determine the price of the gas. It could be simply some kind of inflationary mechanism. But given the nature of the producers, who are frankly accustomed to taking commodity risk, I think they would want to see some kind of commodity risk exposure in that gas price. So, as I say, one approach would be to use an oil index of some sort, which would be, you know, very conventional. The other approach which could be used in this event would be to apply what's called the netback price, such that whatever price is realized for the LNG through a sale in Asia somewhere, some percentage of that would be netted back to the upstream. So, you know, for example, the gas price could be structured at, say, 15% of the sales price or some other number, just an example. But again, that would create much more variability in the earnings and profit pattern in the upstream and the midstream part of the company. So understanding how that gas contract might work and the terms of the indexation hasn't really surfaced in the discussion, in the dialogue, but it's probably something that the legislature will want to focus in on at some point.
Could it be that the purchase price in these contracts that are confidential could have different points of sale on the netback?
Thank you, Chair. Certainly, I would expect naturally that the negotiations between the producers and the LNG company would be carried out independently, that there are some complications around the way in which the joint ventures work on the North Slope, such that I think, my understanding certainly, is that each of the producers has some flexibility around producing their own gas, which we're seeing to some extent in the supply arrangements planned for the Phase 1 pipeline. But when it comes to, you know, a major sale of multiple BCF a day, there would have to be some coordination between them. But the price that they're paid for that gas could be different. And they could each select a different kind of indexation, conceivably.
Senator Stedman.
On the chairman's question, let me try to put a finer point on it. And we'll get into this, I guess, when we get the Department of Revenue here. But my understanding is there's a prevailing price of gas on the North Slope, way in excess of a dollar, maybe 2.5 times that or some number, and that there's a blended sale price of gas, which then would be like similar to in concept to like when we look at TAPS and our oil value, we just look up the, you know, the price of ANS West Coast, and we got the price of oil. It's not different for each company. It's a blended price we're dealing with. And I think that the gas has also a blended price, which may not, you know, some one firm may be high or lower in their negotiated sale than that tax we would use for, or the price that we would use being blended for our tax calculation.
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. I think that's some sort of mechanism like that could well emerge. And again, it emphasizes the importance of the detailed terms of the gas supply agreement. Mm-hmm. The other brief comment I might offer is that I believe the prevailing price of gas on the North Slope is to do with local industrial demand for power generation and so forth. And obviously the economies of scale in terms of the compression and the infrastructure which has to be installed to provide that gas are very different for local industrial demand of that sort compared to more meaningful flow of gas either for the phase one pipeline. So I think it's not surprising that that prevailing cost of gas is a little higher than what's being discussed, but no doubt the details will come out in due course.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, and the concern, I guess, I should have worded the question a little different. I recognize that the prevailing price of gas is basically for internal use of on the North Slope, you know, power generation and so on and so forth. But then the blended price of the value of gas, that's already, my understanding, is in our statutes already. And that might be something that we need to ask revenue if that is an impairment that we need to deal with. Because what we're talking about here today is a full-blown project with export. But later on, when we get into the tax discussion and some of the finer points, we could possibly end up with just an in-state gas line with no export facilities. So we need to have, I guess, some clarity on how we position the state, Mr. Chairman, under both alternatives so we don't end up making a tactical error here, end up with a different project than we actually assumed we were going to have when we went through this legislative work this summer.
Do you have a response?
Thank you, Chairman. And I think I think the Senator Stedman's question there really speaks to the level of detail and full understanding that needs to be addressed prior to FID, basically. The other point which was raised is this question of, the phase one gas line being the only project that happens. And later on in the presentation, I have some illustrative numbers around that, because certainly without increased flow rate, the phase one gas line represents quite a challenging economic prospect or a very high gas price for South Central and Fairbanks customers. So I think this whole question of whether the phase one gas line is an end result or whether it's part of a transition is another key one.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I've heard folks consider the possibility that we only get phase one, but it seems to me like phase one is the hurdle. And so if you just consider phase one creating the reality of gas essentially at Tidewater in these volumes, that the economic incentive to grab that gas, liquefy it, and transport it becomes a pretty compelling economic case. So I guess have you seen anything that would suggest that there could be a situation where we would get the stage one pipeline that far, basically solve the 800-mile problem, and get the gas to a point where it could be picked up and used, and transported? Does that seem like a likely possibility, considering the economics that would be involved once we got the gas to that point?
Thank you, Senator Kaufman, and through the chair. I think it's helpful to kind of step back and consider what that phase one gas line represents. And in effect, it's a very large option. For South Central customers, it represents an option or or a line of sight to considerably lower gas prices to those that exist today, with all the economic benefit that was a result from that. For the producers, it's an option to sell, you know, $1 billion, $1.5 billion worth of gas every year. So again, for them, that option is very, very valuable. And for Glenfarne, it's an option on essentially launching the rest of the project, as you were indicating. So I think if that Phase 1 gas line project were built, there would be a very, very compelling economic case to complete the project and build the liquefaction. But obviously, there's no guarantee. But certainly, you know, you've got three sets of stakeholders, if you like. You've got the gas customers, you've got Glenfarne, you've got the producers, all of whom would be very highly incentivized to ensure that that full project were built subsequently.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll ask questions about cost overruns and fiscal structures and who pays maybe later when you look at some of your Phase 1 slides. On the slides in front of us now, the 11 and 12, you have a last bullet about the tax consequence of fixed price as compared to netback price. And you didn't spend much time on those. Could you talk us through a little bit what the implications would be for the taxing authority there?
Thank you, Senator, and through the chair. As I say, one of the considerations is that the North Slope producers, they are in the business of producing oil and gas, and their shareholders and their investors are accustomed and attracted by the idea of commodity price risk. So I think it would be unusual for those companies to enter into a major sales contract which didn't include some kind of commodity price exposure. Further than that, ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips are two members of a very small group of sort of preeminent global LNG companies. They both have multi-million ton LNG portfolios, and they've both stated LNG growth as being a major part of their strategies. So further than that, you know, I think their interest in the gas as it moves downstream into the LNG market, you know, will be significant, and they will be looking at ways in which they can leverage that with their broader LNG. So from a tax point of view, depending on how far down that road you go, you could go down the road such that the Glenfarne project receives a relatively stable fixed income for the infrastructure, and all the price risk moves to the upstream, in which case you could get, you know, supernormal profits in, for example, at the moment, you know, with LNG prices being extremely high, you would see, under that scenario, you would see all that profit moving to the upstream and being taxed, you know, as production tax and royalty for the gas. Equally, you know, in sort of 2020, 21, when we saw a big dip in LNG prices, you would see quite considerable losses in that area. So this question of how the profits flow and how they get taxed is a material one, and one which could, you know, significantly change the tax outcome for the state.
Senator Keel.
So I noticed in the slide you talk about whether or not whether a portion of the benefits from the project and thus the profits are pushed to that midstream owner, that pipeline and LNG facility owner, and you talk about corporate income tax. When it comes to royalty and production tax, all of our North Slope operators pay that. But when it comes to corporate income tax, a company almost gets to choose how ought we think about the project in front of us and the legislature's duty in that environment.
Thank you, Senator Keel, and through the chair. The most jurisdictions will apply a corporate income tax to operations, you know, in their jurisdiction. Obviously, there are some historical anomalies which apply here in Alaska, and how they get dealt with is probably outside the scope of today's discussion. But from an LNG perspective, clearly appropriate capturing of corporate income tax going forwards might be something that you would want to consider, given that I think the DOR projections suggest it would be $60, $70 million per annum, depending on where the taxes are set, by the sort of 2040 timeframe. So these are fairly significant revenues from corporate income tax, which may or may not be captured, as you mentioned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
And just to the earlier question about the risk of this project, when we look at the potential of the in-state gas line and then the majors coming in to finish it off, possibly, or somebody else with the liquefaction and the conditioning plants or what have you. One of the things that I find curious is that when we look back several years, we had testimony here at the table of why Conoco's in the state. Why is BP here? Why is Exxon? Conoco was here for our oil. BP was here for just harvesting. They were in harvest mode, and that really jacked them up when that hit the table. And Exxon was here for our gas. And if under that scenario, I just find it curious that Exxon's not at the table when it's part of their objective is to get Alaska's gas to market. So there's got to be a reason they're standing on the sideline, selling it at the wellhead or at the edge of the Point Thompson unit. And that's just a data point that might want to help us keep our feet on the ground and not get enamored with these huge dollar amounts 30 years from now. That may or may not ever materialize.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Stedman, through the chair. This partly goes back to the request the chair made a few minutes ago to sort of talk about the current environment, because Exxon, one of their global partnerships is with Qatar Energy, and Qatar has been a major platform for them. They're also investing in a liquefaction plant in the Gulf Coast with Qatar Energy. But of course, things have changed considerably in terms of how Qatar is now perceived because of the clear risk to security of supply and indeed the damage that's been done to some of the trains there. So, you know, one could ask the question whether Exxon are currently reviewing their gas strategy, and a project of the size of Alaska could perhaps be more attractive than it was a few months ago. But time will tell.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. Just wanted to spend just a couple of slides on other sources of economic benefit, because we've heard a lot in the different hearings in the legislature over the last few weeks now about property tax and the ABT, but similar order of magnitude in terms of value to the project is whether or not federal loan guarantees materialize. As I think many of you will know, the legislation, the federal legislation, to enable these federal loan guarantees was put in place some decades ago. The precise regulatory framework in under which that would happen, I think, needs some work, as I understand it. And, of course, now you have the Energy Dominance Fund and various other federal initiatives which ultimately could help to lower the cost of financing the project. But quick back of the envelope, if you assume a cost of debt of 6.5%, which is not untypical in the LNG area, without the federal loan guarantees, if you say it's maybe 5% with them, the flow-through is hundreds of millions of dollars in saving. And from the delivered cost of gas in Asia, it represents quite a material saving, which could help to push the project into economic territory. So it remains to be seen what will happen on this, but it is a material factor which ultimately will hinge on federal government policy.
So on this topic, since it has been decades since this loan guarantee was brought forward, and the President of the United States has said that the development of this project is important to the nation, why haven't we heard anything from the federal government saying certain things that they could, actions that they could take to push this along? It just seems to be a general resolution.
Thank you, Chair. And certainly, as you'll recall, Glenfarne entered into the transaction with AGDC just before the election last year. Or was it two years ago now? And subsequently, we saw a number of executive orders and so forth, which came out very positively in support of developing Alaska's resources. Clearly, there are many features of federal policy under, you know, constantly being developed and evolved. But I think all one can say is that as yet, none of the moves from the federal side appear to have resulted in a kind of a material agreement relating to the AKLNG project. There's been a lot of support for trade missions to Asia and so forth, and certainly I think Asian countries are being encouraged to enter into agreements for American LNG, and including Alaska. But currently there doesn't appear to be a tangible federal step to help the project.
So it would seem as though this loan guarantee could potentially be critical, and with the inflationary numbers that we have, the purchasing power of $20 billion has substantially been reduced. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the other interesting element of additional value for the project is the gas treatment plant, which is there to treat the gas to LNG quality. As I think many people will be aware, carbon dioxide in the gas to be liquefied can't be tolerated, even down to a few parts per million. So one of the key prerequisites for the LNG is to remove the CO2. Because of the changes in federal policy around tax credits and so forth since the original project, one of the additional benefits which didn't apply to the original project is the ability to collect these tax credits. So they currently stand at $85 a ton of CO2. I think from AGDC testimony, I think the target CO2 removal from the North Slope would be around 7 million tons. So, you know, clearly we're looking at, you know, a fairly significant saving as well, similar order of magnitude. So 60 cents per MMBTU of delivered gas. So around about $600 million per year of tax credit. One of the interesting features around these tax credits is that often you have to sell them to people who can use them. So there's an element of commercial structuring around that gas treatment plant and who might own it, which are relevant here. And, of course, the other feature of the CO2 is that it can be used for enhanced oil recovery. Now, exactly which oil fields on the slope could be candidates for EOR using CO2 remains to be determined, I think. But nonetheless, I think for every ton of CO2 injected, there's the potential for a 3 to 5 barrels of oil additional production. So I think it's quite conceivable that that CO2 will have a value to some of the North Slope producers, and that too could generate some revenue for the project. But that's a topic which remains to be seen. But the one thing we do know is that under current federal law, there would be a 12-year period over which this $85 a ton inflated would be available to the project.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulford, I'm interested in the notion that I hadn't thought through that these credits affecting the ownership structure of a gas treatment plant. Can you just build out a little more the notion that I can't quote what you said, but it's going to affect who can own this thing? What are we talking about?
Thank you, Senator, and through the chair. Looking at the lower 48 where these carbon capture projects are quite significantly under development, because the tax credits are quite material in the context of the investment, using them, monetizing them is the key. So the favored ownership structure for these plants is using a tax partnership. And all I know is that tax attorneys look very carefully at these structures to ensure that the way the credits flow results in $85 of value. Another way of doing it is to facilitate a mechanism whereby the credits can be sold to somebody else and then used, in which case you'd probably get maybe 80, 90 cents on the dollar for the credits. But the way in which the ownership structure around the CCUS plant is established is kind of pivotal to the whole project and making sure that those credits are monetized. So I would imagine quite a bit of, you know, tax attorney work involved in setting up exactly how the ownership of the project might need to function. So it may have implications for equity in terms of who can take equity in it. But I think with appropriate structuring, some kind of arrangement could be made.
Senator Keel.
Just to follow up, thank you. In the proposal that is under development now, do you have a sense of how, were the state to elect maximum equity that is available to us, would there be offsets if we ought not be an equity owner in a gas treatment plant? Would we have a greater equity stake in some other piece of the project? How would that be structured then?
Thank you, through the chair. The fact that each sub-project has been set up with a separate ownership structure around the kind of 8-star holding company does mean exactly that you know, the state can elect to take equity or not. I think of the three units, the equity around the treatment plant is probably the most complex because of the reasons I've mentioned. But I wouldn't be in a position to comment really on what the broader implications might be. But it's something that will need to be looked at.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
Don't we already own 25% of that? 75-25 is a split between us and Glen Farm, is my understanding.
So my understanding is that the 75-25 split relates to the holding company, and that as and when FID is taken on the sub-companies, capital will be, you know, put into those companies, who will then potentially pay a dividend up to the holding. So my understanding is that the state has 25% in the holding company, but as and when FID is taken on these other three units, that there will be a further election that will have to be made.
Senator Stedman.
Who owns the three sub-companies then?
Currently, they are owned by 8-Star, the holding company, but then they have no assets. I think at the point they have assets assigned to them, then equity in those subcontracts, sub-projects will be set. And we talked earlier about the likelihood that potentially other equity investors will participate in the project. So, you know, they would probably be present in those sub-project companies as well.
Senator Stedman.
It gets into the dilution question. So, in essence, we own, through 8-Star, 25% of the sub-companies, because we own 25% of 8-Star, is my understanding. And then when they go out to bring in other investors, we'll suffer a dilution issue. And the question is, how big is the dilution issue? We have no idea. We could be diluted down without taking an equity position as a new investor in one of those three sub-companies. Then we're 8-Star, we'll be diluted, and we'll own 25% of whatever the diluted value of 8-Star is. Is that not correct?
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, I think I followed your logic. And certainly, once FID is taken on those three subunits, the state's 25% of the holding company may or may not have significant value.
Senator Stedman?
My concern, it will have no value, or virtually no value. 8-Star in the end.
Thank you, Senator. I think that's a valid question, maybe one to address to Glen Farm and AGDC.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Thank you. Well, at this juncture, and I know we're getting fairly short of time, so I can probably go through these slides fairly quickly, but for illustrative purposes...
Take as much time as you need.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what I've set out on this slide is the gas supply cost that would have to apply for the pipeline element of the project to reach a 10% rate of return under different scenarios. So I've taken three levels of capital investment. $10, $12, and $14 billion. And I've looked at it using two flow rates. And what you can derive from that slide, I think, is that without a significant increase in the forecasted flow rate through the pipeline, the ultimate cost to really the gas utility buying the gas would be relatively high. So I know, you know, a $12 price has been put out there as being the sort of notional price of gas through the pipeline. And you'll see from that that with a relatively conservative $10 billion capital cost and with a 500 million standard cubic feet per day flow rate, you can just about get down to the $12 per million BTU. But in all the other scenarios, you're looking at something more. So on the next slide, I've reversed the question and said, well, if the price paid by the gas utility is $12, what does that mean in terms of the rate of return on the pipeline? So what you note here is, as before, with the 500 million standard cubic feet per day and the lower capital, then you can just about get to a 10% rate of return. But if it's a lower rate, 300 million standard cubic feet, for example, and a higher capital cost, then the return on the pipeline is very low. So that sets out the challenges of the phase one pipeline. If there aren't any mechanisms to bring up the flow rate. Conversely, if you look at it from the other side of the equation.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, we're moving a little too fast for my small mind coming from an island that we buy oil and we buy electricity. So when we look at these prices, $12, that's roughly $1.50 oil, if I'm not mistaken, in equivalency at 80% efficiency of oil, around $4 or 4 cents per kilowatt. I think it would be very informative, Mr. Chairman, as we go through this to help people understand what we're talking about in dollars, equivalency of kilowatts and price per oil. And you could use 80% or 90% efficiency conversion on oil, whatever you want to do, if you've got a monitor stove or an old boiler. So we can get a benchmark of what we're talking about here. Because $17 per MMBTU, well, $20 doesn't even get to $3 oil. So it would be nice to take a look at these conversions, because I think the spin rate on a hydro is 4 cents, somewhere in that range. And that would be fairly close to that $12 MMBTU. And one of the concerns that we all have sitting at the table here is, I think, in this building, is that we don't make a mistake and we end up putting a rail belt in a position where they have excessively high energy costs and really hurt our economy. But it's hard to do the conversion unless we see a scale of equivalency. So that would be helpful as we go forward. I don't know what Fairbanks is, you know, cost of oil at $4 oil, that's $30 natural gas per BTU, just to give a scale on what we're dealing with here. That's important.
And for the committee's information, first delivery of the fuel barges in Dillingham, Alaska this last weekend, the prices of gas were posted at $9.09 a gallon, and heating oil is probably going to be around that, if not slightly higher than that. So just for everybody to digest that number.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
That's $65 per MMBTU.
I'll take 12.
But I think it would be helpful. And then I think, too, as we get on in this subject later on, it'd be nice to get a cash flow breakdown of the project in more detail through the construction when they're asking for concessions from the state. And I recognize that, you know, we have a very high millage rate. But it would be nice to look at the cash flow through the construction to first gas so we can actually see when the cash calls come into play for property tax.
And okay. While we're talking about this topic, I understand that the rail belt uses natural gas, but while we were discussing Senate Bill 138, as a member of this committee, I said that I thought it was a mistake that Alaska did not look at use of that gas, that oil, in-state. It was just monetizing it, and the citizens of Alaska did not get any lower energy costs when we were providing the nation at that point between 25% to 28% of the oil supply for all of the United States. And I believe that we also should be looking at fixing that when we're talking about developing gas and selling gas for in-state use. Just my viewpoint. Do you have a comment, Mr. Fulford, on Senator Stedman's statement?
Thank you, Chair, and certainly in relation to the comment from Senator Stedman, Alaska has its unique energy challenges, and certainly one of the main benefits of the project, if it goes through in its full form, is that it would transform the cost of energy for the rail belt, for Fairbanks, etc. All I would say is that in the context of big LNG projects like this, the terms of supply for the domestic market are often fully integrated into the sort of legislative framework for the project, even down to legislating a price for the gas. And you know what? The other thing you often see is a domestic market reservation, such that a certain proportion of the gas that's produced for LNG has to go first to the domestic market. It's interesting what they've just done in Australia, where obviously they had a huge push to build LNG export facilities, so much so that it's now put pressure on gas prices for eastern Australia. So a new piece of legislation came in the other day, enabling or already forcing some percentage of that LNG volume to be offered up to the domestic market before export. So this question of LNG pricing and framework versus energy supply for the host government, it's one that very, very often comes up, and there are often special terms that apply to what in this case would be in-state gas supply in relation to the LNG project structure.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the project is being focused on in-state gas. Right? My district is pretty far away from in-state gas. I mean, I could move out to Adak Island probably and be about as close. But the value that I think my district sees is the enhanced expansion of the oil basin itself, allowing more players into the Prudhoe Bay arena, and the longevity of our basin itself and longevity of TAPS, which has enormous financial benefit to the state and all its citizens. And as the chairman referenced, there might be some residual direct benefit from the gas line itself into a holding account and then distributed to the rural areas or non-rail belt communities to help them with their energy costs. So I think this project goes much further than just in-state gas, because we are going to use just a fraction of the capacity. And we'll get into that here at some point. But we're basically a non-consequential user of this project.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and that brings up, and not to be discussed at this point, but at a later point, takeoff points that, particularly on the Yukon, that affects Senator Cronk's district and his communities, which is not part of the discussion that Glenn Farn has brought forward. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair. And perhaps coming back for a moment to Senator Stedman's comment there about the broader benefits to Alaska, it is true that, when people talk about stranded gas generally, one of the first examples that they point to is the North Slope, where, you have this huge gas resource, but currently no way to monetize it in the market. And so I would say that one of the broader benefits of the LNG project would be to provide that kind of outlet for gas, which could then enable additional oil production and would enhance the economics of oil production, which today doesn't exist. So certainly as a mechanism for continuing investment and even broadening investment into other basins, the LNG project does have a value in that context.
And people should be keeping in mind, in the listening audience, that we're talking about 35 trillion cubic feet of proven reserves. That number is probably going to go up substantially as new fields are discovered. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Another quick point here, real quick. We brought that up several years ago in the other project under 138, and that's when the industry will be able to book the reserves on their balance sheet. So it would be nice for us to touch on that sometime as we go through this process, because it's a significant asset booking when they could book this gas.
That's a very valid comment, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Thank you. So the last point I wanted to make around the phase one gas supply is, as and when the LNG project does come to fruition, then, of course, the effect you were seeing with the lack of economies of scale in the last two slides is reversed, and the potential for gas delivery to NSTAR or Chugach or one of the utilities for less than $5 becomes a reality. So with the additional 3 BCF of gas coming down the line for the LNG, the economics of energy supply to Fairbanks and South Central is transformed. So really that's what this slide says. So I wanted to finish off, for the most part, talking about the LNG market. One of the illustrative pieces of material that's been used in the various hearings to date has been this so-called break-even matrix from Department of Revenue, which I personally find exceptionally helpful in communicating, you know, where this project sits in terms of global market. Mr. Stickle has explained this matrix, I think, to you. And what it ultimately means is that if you can push the break-even price of delivery to Asia to the top left-hand corner of this matrix, then you have an exceptionally competitive project. The more you move away from that top left corner, whether it's because the capex invested in the project is higher or whether it's the gas supply price that's higher, you then start eroding the competitiveness of the project. And ultimately, of course, you get to the point where you simply cannot deliver gas at a competitive price. So the first thing I did with this chart is to look at the last 10 years of LNG deliveries into Asia. So I used the Japanese customs data for imported LNG. And from 2016 to 2026, the average was $10.41. So what I did with this chart was I drew a box around the entries in the box that would result in a delivered price to Asia of less than $10.41. So effectively, this is a kind of a what I've called a zone of profitability. And you can see the difference between the existing property tax mechanism and the governor's bill proposed a couple of months back with the 6 cents per MMBTU, per MCF AVT. So what you can see there is that zone of profitability is expanded somewhat. So what that means is that the project could sustain a higher increase in capital cost, or it could sustain a higher gas price and still remain competitive against that 10-year price. So that was my kind of starting point. And again, I think it's worth highlighting the cost of the LNG project in Alaska is indeed very, very high indeed. But the cost of the delivered gas to Asia is not necessarily high. And it's because of the short shipping distance and the relatively low cost of gas that enables you to do that. So when we talk about the cost of the project, I think it's useful to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples. Yes, it's from a capital point of view, it's costly, but from a delivered gas point of view, it need not be.
Senator Stedman and Senator Keel.
On this chart here on previous page, whatever it was, 19, what's the capital cost used? Because that's one of the, I guess, indigestion points that we have is the lack of our using dated capital costs. Could you help us with that? Then I got a comment.
Yes, thank you, Senator, through the chair. This uses the DOR base capex assumption, which is, I believe, $46 billion, which is inflated from one of the previous capital cost estimates that was put out there, I think, in a Wood Mac report a couple of years ago.
$35 billion?
Well, I think $35 billion was certainly around at one time, but I think that's probably wishful thinking these days. So, yes, base capex is $46 billion in this example.
Senator Stedman. But
just for clarity, is that today's value or is that $46 billion is the base 10 years ago extrapolated out with inflation?
$46 billion is today's value.
Yeah, well, okay. So I hope when Glen Farm comes in here and has a discussion, they use a little more accurate numbers because this committee has spent year after year after year dealing with construction projects all across the state. And we have massive inflation and cost escalations over the last decade to the point where we've had to put in tens of millions of dollars backfill for OMB. Excuse me, not OMB, but our contractors to facilitate the completion of their contracts, even several years ago dealing with asphalt. So that number is complete garbage, and it makes it very misleading. So we're going to have to deal with that somehow at this table to get a rough idea of what actual costs we're looking at, especially when somebody's going to sit at the end of the table and ask for a concession. Because if they need a concession on a $45 billion project, what are they going to ask for when it's $70 billion?
Thank you, Senator Stedman, through the chair. I think you've hit there on, perhaps one of the major features that needs to be addressed and developed with the developer.
And if I could, I think what I'm referring to here is the base cost, not inadvertent cost overruns. And I think at some point we're going to have a discussion over LNG Canada, sitting right south of Ketchikan, and their significant financial impacts they had on cost overruns to the point where Ottawa had to come in and bail them out. So, we need to have, as accurate a numbers as absolutely possible.
And I don't think we have the numbers here at the table, and I don't think anyone remembers, but we need to get the projected cost of the Trans-Alaska pipeline and the actual cost, which was substantially higher than doubled from my recollection. But for the committee's reference, that information would be very interesting to have, and we will get that those numbers for the committee to review. Senator Keel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulford, I actually have wanted to ask the ignorant question about when a project goes to FID. You've got the best cost estimates and engineering you can get. Everybody signs. And unexpected costs do pop up. as the co-chair Stedman said, with public transportation infrastructure projects, we know where those get covered. Within the LNG industry, pipeline and LNG industry, where do those get covered? Is it a mixture of going back to gas suppliers and lowering their cost? Is it lowering the pipeline builder's profit over time? Is it raising cost to the customer? Is it the public fisc? I mean, how's that work in the industry?
Thank you, Senator Keel. It's probably worth, through the chair, it's probably worth dividing projects up into those which are pure LNG export projects and then those which involve some degree of in-state supply or gasification of the host government. But for LNG projects that are kind of intended just for gas export, the cost inflation after FID, which certainly for some of the Australian projects has been a huge issue, it typically gets dealt with in two ways. You know, one is that some of it has to be absorbed by the equity investors. But particularly after some of the, you know, very, very significant cost escalation, which we've seen in some LNG projects, these days, some degree of cost guarantee is pushed onto the EPC contractor. And then, of course, you're into the question of change orders and changes to the design and so forth. But with a project of this scale, there will be very significant and well-capitalized EPC companies building it, but even they wouldn't have the balance sheet to support more than, I would say, a modest cost difference. And indeed, EPC contractors, not surprisingly, do charge for taking price risk. You know, if you let a contract that doesn't have a price cap, the price will be less than one that does, because it's a question of risk and reward. So on a project of this scale, certainly you'd want to ensure that the equity stakeholders involved have sufficient scope and capacity to absorb some degree of cost escalation. The key question, of course, which applies in this case, is what effect might that have on in-state gas supply? And I think I've heard reference to testimony which suggests that following FID on the gas pipeline element of the project, that the gas tariffs negotiated as part of that package would be unaffected by cost escalation. But I'm not sure that I've seen that set out in writing.
Senator Keel. Thank you. And I warned you it was an ignorant question. When you say equity investors will absorb, does that mean write another check? Or does that mean we're going to go borrow the difference and you'll get a lower return on the check you already wrote us? Or something else?
Thank you, Senator Keel. That's a good question. It's a combination. And it depends on the sort of financial management decisions of the equity participants. But yes, often additional borrowing would be required. And, you know, there are some projects that have put considerable strain on the balance sheets of the companies involved because of these cost overruns.
If I may.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. That's helpful, and it's putting my head in a decent spot. I think you said that was... that answer was specific to pure LNG export projects. What is the historical trend? What tends to happen in projects where there is a local gas supply component as well? How does that differ?
That's another excellent question through the chair. I mentioned earlier in today's meeting that domestic supply is often woven into the very core of the LNG legislation in the host nation. And when that happens, as I say, sometimes the price of domestic gas is fixed that there's a determination that, let's say, $5 an MMBTU is the price which will enable the domestic market to function and to use gas. And in that case, regardless of where the costs of the project end up, because that number is sort of burnt into contract, it stays where it is. I think somebody made the comment earlier that once the LNG project here is kind of fully functioning, that the economic significance of in-state supply is relatively low. And so it's conceivable that, I think in the bigger picture, some kind of protection for in-state supply could be worked into the broader framework for the project, because there are probably bigger elements that the project developer needs to concern themselves with.
Senator Keel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That would be something you could write in at the beginning. My worry is about cost overruns once FID has happened and where that cash comes from to take care of the in-state supply. I share Senator Stedman's belief that if we have a gas line, there will be additional oil down taps. I also share an element in my district that there won't be any gas coming here from that. If my district were to get gas, it would come from Canada. It's just geography, right? So I very much want affordable gas into Senator Kaufman's district. I have several family members who live in his district. That's important to me, but I also have to protect my constituents to whom I'm accountable from calls on the Treasury for gas they won't get. So I'm trying to figure out where the risk points are, and I appreciate that.
You will take care of it.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Keel, Senator Kaufman, and then Senator Stedman.
Thank you. Mr. Fulford, there's these hearings are often a cloud of considerations, of concerns, all the many things that people think of to wonder and worry about. I'm just curious, given your expertise and the capabilities of Gavney Klein, have you produced or been asked to produce a tabulation that could be what's essentially a decision support package? So we have to decide what to do, and we have to consider as many aspects as possible. And there's cases where we have all the information that we need. There's cases where we may not. There's cases where we might not be able to access that because of some interpretation of confidentiality. There may need to be some workaround, essentially a skiff for that or something where we could go in and look at certain things under some sort of agreement. One of the problems I think that the committees that have been chewing on this get into is the cloud of information and not getting it racked into a tabulation that we can move through it, not necessarily linearly, but in parallel, because we're going to get this done. We've got a lot of stuff that we've got to work on. And so we need to know what those are and task that out to the different entities, the stakeholders, or participants in this process that can answer those questions and get things nailed down so that we have a clean agenda of what we need to do legislatively to consider either in this piece of legislation or in subsequent legislation, give it a criticality on a sequence of events to create some forward momentum in this, if it's going to have forward momentum. Has such a product ever been asked for or created?
Thank you, Senator Kaufman, and through the chair. As it happens, some of my colleagues are working on a decision support package on another project thousands of miles away. Our role in that is diligence on behalf of one of the investors leading up to FID. So I think that's exactly the kind of type of package that you're referring to, which is a kind of a soup to nuts evaluation of the project from beginning to end. Our role typically has been to provide the diligence to look at that DSP, decision support package. In this case, it's been prepared by one of the major project developers. And certainly a huge amount of work, you know, has gone into preparing that. So I think maybe at a subsequent meeting, I'm very happy to sort of talk about what typically goes into that. But I think preparing a full decision support package would probably rest with one of the developers.
Senator Kaufman.
And I agree. I'm talking about in concept. Now, our task is not to do the project. So we don't have to do all of those things that, or assure all of those things. But there's the piece of that type of process that could be tailored to knock out the legislative tasks that we need to do, the legislative considerations, and could just help us surface some of these things that come up in conversations. You're talking about one thing, the person next to you thinks of another thing. And I think we have to fight back against the information cloud a little bit and get things, again, racked into some sort of tabulation where we can say, okay, we've got this, we've got that figured out, we've got this. We need to know this, and how are we going to find out about that? And then we can work on those things. And it doesn't have to be anywhere as near as comprehensive as what a major capital project document might be for that, because our goal is just to come up with the legislative pieces that we really need to do on the timeline that we're in right now. And so I think some simplified version of that would be very helpful.
Thank you, Senator. And perhaps we can develop some ideas and bring them back to committee.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Stedman?
I got a point to make, but just on this last question, I think we've asked well over a year ago if we needed to do anything from the state's perspective, and the answer was no. We don't need to do anything. Just stay out of the way, and they're going to go build it. So I think they missed that mark by a mile. And we knew it, a lot of us that have been around, that that's not at all the case. But that's the line of razzle-dazzle they gave us. But to the utility question and the concern dealing with the rail belt and cost overruns, I think back on another project when we were looking at the construction of the Continental Line heading down towards Chicago area, there was a lot of discussion on how to finance it, and one of the proposals that was brought up and talked about was the utilities are going to back it. And that's what we were told by the then administration. Well, the utilities can't back it. They can't afford to take the cost overrun positions, and they're barred by the regulators to do that. And I think that's one of the questions we need to find out from our regulatory environment. But my expectation is the utilities and rail belt will not be allowed to do that. It would wipe them out, the scale. And same with the old Continental Line. They would be barred. But we sat in the governor's conference room and were told point blank that that's how it was going to be financed. And that was just complete BS. So we need to clarify the state's position on that, Mr. Chairman. But I'll be shocked if they could back this and expose themselves to cost overruns.
Thank you. Do you have a comment, Mr. Folkford, on Senator Stedman's statement?
Thank you, Chair. I would say in response to Senator Stedman's remarks that one consideration certainly is that the RCA and the existing regulatory framework that they operate under is probably worth looking at in some detail in the sense that it was probably never really designed for a project at this scale with such wide-ranging economic consequences for the South Central area and indeed Fairbanks. So examining the current regulatory framework and considering what it might have to look like to guard against scenarios such as Senator Stedman described is certainly something I think which probably warrants examination.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Thank you. So the next three slides involve more pricing data, really. So This is a graphical representation of what I used to come up with the 10-year average price that I used for the zone of profitability. And you can see that the price of LNG into Japan has been relatively volatile over the last 10 years. There was a relative softening of price really in the lead-up to kind of 2018 when a lot of U.S. LNG was coming onto the market. Then we saw this big dip around 2020 caused by the industrial demand collapse from COVID. And then, of course, we had the Ukraine crisis, which created a very tight LNG supply environment, mainly because Europe was using up so much LNG, much of which came from the U.S. I also put the current forward curve on there, which gives you some sense of how much prices have jumped since the military action in the Middle East. But of course, you know, in terms of that forward price, it does stabilize again over the next couple of years. So that blue or turquoise rectangle represents the zone where, based on the previous slide, the Alaska profit would have been profitable. In other words, they could have delivered gas to Asia, to Japan, and secured a reasonable return on the project. Where the orange line diverges from the blue rectangle, those are areas where the project would be put under some pressure. Bearing in mind, of course, that LNG is a long-term business, so in investing in the LNG, you would expect to see these periods of firmer or softer pricing. But anyway, graphically speaking, that gives you a sense of where the project is. The dotted line on there represents the incremental zone of profitable gas deliveries, which would arise from the 6 cents per MCF AVT. So you can see that there's a movement downwards, enabling the project to be more profitable over time. So if we take that still further,
Do you have a question on that slide, Senator Stedman?
Yes, when he's done with this slide, I have a question.
And when you're looking at this slide and the drastic drop from Iran down, what estimation are you giving that drop to ending the war, if any?
Thank you, Chair. And that's, again, it's a very timely and opportune question because clearly over the last few weeks, some information has come out in terms of the extent of the damage that's occurred to the Qatari LNG trains. As you may be aware, Qatar had relatively recently embarked on a very substantial growth program involving quite a number of new LNG trains. I think is at least another 30 million tons of LNG, possibly more than that. So that whole kind of growth plan has been pushed back a number of years, is my understanding. But I think the more fundamental point, and probably the one which is of most relevant to Alaska, is not necessarily those sort of short or medium-term disruptions to supply, but the fact that LNG coming through the Gulf is now perceived as being somewhat unreliable. And certainly for an Asian economy that relies very heavily on LNG. And you look at Pakistan and India, for example. Pakistan in particular had a particularly strong reliance on Qatari LNG. So within days of the conflict, they were having to shut off industry. They were having to put in place, 3-day-a-week programs and so forth for their power. So right there's a real example of the implications of being too reliant on a particular supplier. So, of course, you compare and contrast that with Alaska. relatively short shipping distance to Asia across the Pacific, no real navigational hazards in between. So the events will definitely place more interest and activity in Pacific LNG purchases compared to prior to the conflict. So these are factors which should provide what I'd call fundamental drivers for an Alaska project and people interested in buying gas.
Please proceed, Mr. Fulford. Senator Stedman.
Yes, I have a question on this chart. Just for background, there's a decade and a half, or maybe back two decades ago, there's the oil cocktail that created the LNG price in Japan. And as time moved on, I think the countries tried to get away from the oil cocktail, pricing LNG against the relative price of oil. Can you give us kind of a brief update on where that is? Have they broken the oil cocktail, or is it still the majority of the price indexing used in Asia?
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. I talked previously about indexation for the gas supply into the project, and the same factors really apply to indexation for LNG buyers. I think many commentators would suggest that in due course there'll be some kind of global clearing price for natural gas in the same way that you have, Brent and other oil indexes which occur today. But we're not there yet. So you have this array of different prices which do affect one another. One of the emerging gas indices in the Asian theater is JKM, which is called Japan Korea Marker is the full name. It's run by Platts. But I think some buyers had begun to move a lot of their LNG purchases towards that kind of index. But the problem with the index is that the trading is still relatively shallow. So every time there's a supply disruption, JKM can go up. I think certainly during Ukraine, it was up to $100 a barrel. $100 an MMBTU, which is equivalent to $600 or $700 a barrel of oil. So there has been some caution at moving away from oil. What has become quite common, and it's going to be an interesting question for the Alaska LNG sales, is moving towards so-called hybrid pricing. So the indexation could comprise some oil. It could comprise some Henry Hub, for example. Now that U.S. exports have such a fundamental effect on the market, so Henry Hub indexation is becoming more common. Certainly in Europe, TTF, which is the Netherlands index, that's become common in LNG. So, there is this trend away from just oil, but certainly for Asian LNG buyers, oil still tends to be quite a popular way to index.
Senator Stedman?
No, that's fine.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Okay.
Do you have a brief at ease?
At ease. Call the meeting back to order. We do have prior commitments. So what we're going to do is take a recess until 1:30. If members of the Finance Committee want some time to schedule with Mr. Fulford, I think you could check with Senator Gray Jackson. Her staffer is going to be able to schedule time, but we'll recess until 1:30. Do you have any closing comments, Mr. Fulford, before we adjourn till 1:30?
Thank you, Chair. No, I think I'll defer my comments to the recommencement of the meeting. Thank you.
This afternoon's 1:30 meeting will probably be less than an hour, but with that, we will recess until 1:30. We'll call the Senate Finance Committee back to order from today, this morning's meeting. It is 1:30. We have Senator Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Cronk, Senator Kaufman, and Jesse Bergman. Senator Bergman is here as well. We have a quorum to do business. We will continue on. Oh, I forgot our illustrious President Senator Stevens is with us. So with that, Nicholas Fulford, please identify yourself and proceed with this morning's presentation.
Thank you, Chairman. And so this is Nicholas Fulford, Senior Director at Gaffney Klein, continuing with the presentation from this morning. So I think we'd finished the dialogue on this pricing slide. And so the next section in the slide pack relates to the LNG activity that's happening just south of here in Canada and British Columbia. And just before we move into that section, I think really there's two things to remember in the context of AKLNG. The first is that for the foreseeable future, LNG prices will be determined by U.S. Gulf Coast export economics. This is really because, you know, as we discussed this morning, Qatar represents the kind of initial building block of LNG demand. It's so low cost that it will always take the first piece of demand. Then you have various other projects and so forth. But where people are looking for incremental demand these days is from the U.S. Gulf Coast, partly because there's already a lot of LNG capacity there. A lot of it that is there is being expanded. And then there's a whole slew of LNG projects being built, some of which have got to FID, some haven't. But either way, there's a perception that the U.S. Gulf Coast is a little bit like a tap for LNG, that, you know, when there's demand, you can turn the tap and a little bit more will come on. So that's relevant to Alaska because, you know, something we'll, I'm sure, return to. But one of the key features for Alaska is that when you look at that delivered cost to Asia, it's going to have to be roughly the same or slightly less than that U.S. Gulf Coast marginal price. So that's one consideration. Now, the second consideration from a competition point of view is Canada. And the reason for that is that the economics of LNG coming out of Canada are broadly the same as that in Alaska. The gas price, the input gas price that they have to pay, is slightly higher than the numbers that we've been seeing reported in the press for Alaska. But the gas is relatively dry, relatively clean, and so the need for that very large CO2 removal plant it doesn't exist. So on in very basic terms, the cost of gas coming into the Alaskan plant plus the cost of the gas processing plant needs to be roughly equal to the cost of producing gas in British Columbia. That's broadly speaking the equation. Most of the gas projects in Canada involve a long-distance pipeline, and that includes LNG Canada. But by and large, Canada shares with Alaska this geographic advantage of being able to deliver gas quickly and at low risk to markets in Asia. So if you look at what's been happening in Canada, probably 8 or 10 years ago now, there were perhaps 5 or 6 different LNG export projects on the books. Some of them were on the large scale, some of them smaller. But the one project that finally made it to FID was what's known as LNG Canada in Kitimat. And the BC Parliament, the legislature, they started looking at LNG legislation in about 2013. They got to FID on LNG Canada in 2018. And over that time, there were quite a number of different changes in legislative approach and strategy, which ultimately enabled that FID. So they did succeed. LNG Canada started delivering about 18 months ago, a little bit more now. And so they've got 14 million tons in delivery. They are contemplating a second phase of another 14 million tons. And there are a number of other LNG projects out there, which I'll come on to. So in the sense that capital and investment is globally mobile, there are investors who would be comparing and contrasting right now the projects in Canada with the project here in Alaska, and considering a whole range of things, including gas availability, risk, fiscal stability, and ultimately the economics. So as you consider the tax arrangements for AKLNG, whether it be property tax or something different, a lot of these international investors will be looking at which is the most favorable tax environment to operate in, and obviously along with the other things like how much gas there is and how much it costs. So let's go through some of the other projects. My favorite one to start with in the context of AKLNG is the Ksi-Lishims project, which is potentially a 12 million ton floating LNG project, literally just a few hundred yards from the Alaskan border. And as it says on the slide there, as the crow flies, it's about 60 miles from Ketchikan. So it's a very local project, but it's on the Canadian side of the border. So that project is at a similar stage of development to the one you have here in Alaska. Elements of the pipeline exist already. Some elements would need to be built. It's a three-way joint venture between the First Nations community who are hosting the terminal, just there on the canal. There's an amalgam of British Columbia gas producers, and then there's a Houston-based energy infrastructure fund that's behind it too. So it's a three-way joint venture. And they are busy looking for customers. They've already signed up Shell and Total with a couple of million tons each, and Total have also committed equity. You've got Cedar LNG, which is much, much smaller, but nevertheless still underway. And then there's Wood Fiber, which is another smaller one, which doesn't involve a pipeline. In the sense that it leverages the pipeline already going to Vancouver. So I think this goes to show that when it comes to investment in LNG, you do have some very active and potentially competing projects just to the south, and that is probably going to be one of your considerations as you legislate around the project here in Alaska. One of the, as I say, one of the differences is that the way these projects procure gas is a little bit different to how it will happen here. They're having to essentially contend with the same gas market that the British, that the Gulf Coast LNG exporters do. And although Western Canadian gas prices are typically considerably lower than Henry Hub down in the lower 48, that the two prices are linked. So if Henry Hub goes up, then so will the cost of the Canadian LNG. Whereas in Alaska, you know, because of the isolated nature of the gas, that it has no commercial linkage, at least, with Henry Hub. So I'll pause at that point briefly for any questions about these Canadian projects that might seem relevant.
Do you have questions from Senate Finance members? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulford, I think in an earlier slide you had a number of other LNG projects around the Pacific Ocean, over into, in fact, the eastern coast of Africa as well. Is there a reason we should be looking more at Canadian potential competition than at Tanzania and Papua New Guinea and the others?
Thank you, Senator Keel, and through the chair. That's a very valid question. It's clearly, at the moment, the project in Tanzania is well advanced and has been on the brink of FID for some time now. And with everything that's happened in the LNG industry, I would expect that project to receive a boost from that. So they may well get the project over the wire. Mozambique is another one which is just about to enter the market. They've got two floating LNG units already operating, and they're contemplating a third land-based one. That's another interesting compare and contrast with Alaska, in the sense that one of the reasons that land-based, much larger-scale LNG project hasn't been built yet is the security situation in northern Mozambique and the problems of operating a large construction camp in the midst of that disruption. So that project was under a force majeure claim, so that the producers had declared force majeure, which meant that they were relieved of their contractual obligations to pursue the project while that was going on, but that's been lifted now. So all those, certainly Mozambique, Tanzania, they are very well positioned to supply India and Pakistan, so those are probably the key markets. But nevertheless, that gas could easily reach the same markets that this is aimed for.
Can you give us, the construction cost for each of these, the top three projects, pipeline size and the length of the lines?
Chairman, I think we can do that. I don't have those numbers at my fingertips. I mean, LNG Canada, the biggest cost overrun with that project was the pipeline. I think the liquefaction, I recall it was about $1,300 or $1,400 per ton per annum. So for 14, that'd be about $20 billion. Anyway, I'll come back to you with some numbers. But certainly the pipeline that was built, there were a number of issues with it. One was that COVID hit right in the middle of construction. So, of course, that created, a very chaotic environment, which led to cost increases. The other factor for that project is that I think there are about 19 First Nations tribes that were involved in the right-of-way for the pipeline. And I think when FID was taken, agreements were in place with the vast majority of those entities, but the lack of agreement with some of the others caused some delays and protests and legal delays to the pipeline. So I think I'd have to check back, but yeah, I'd prefer to check back just in case. But it was about a doubling of the cost of the pipeline. What I would say about that project, and again, it's a lesson that applies to many others. They're on the brink of reaching FID on another 14 million tons. Obviously, that adds considerably to the sort of economies of scale for around the pipeline and the other infrastructure that had to be built. So the financial return on that second expansion will be considerably better than the first. So even though there was a doubling of the cost of the pipeline, that project now looks potentially quite attractive because of the way it's turned out. So based on just phase one, I think the economics would have been somewhat underwater, but now that they've got this phase two ready to go, I think the economics would have improved a lot.
And on these projects, what concessions did British Columbia make to build the lines, if any?
Thank you, Chairman. And that's probably a good segue into the next slide.
You have a question on the previous slide, Senator Stedman?
No, Mr. Chairman, but I'd like to add, it'd be nice when we look at these three projects, if he could break down the cost overruns, which ones had cost overruns and what the cost overruns were targeted at, because we always get and hear about the quality of the work being done on the Alaska project and that it's not going to have cost overruns because their quality is so high. So I would assume that these projects here had similar caliber consultants and construction companies and engineering companies working on them that Alaska would have.
That's a good comment, Senator, through the chair. The other difference, the relevant difference between certainly LNG Canada and the Alaska project is that the pipeline was routed through some very difficult terrain over the Rocky Mountains, and I think technically that was one of the challenges there. Obviously, in Alaska, the pipeline routing is pretty well known, so I think that potentially is one less risk in the context of cost overruns in Alaska. But yes, we can come back with details on cost overruns on these projects, the ones that have been built, certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sidman. Please proceed.
Thank you. So the LNG Canada story is an interesting one, and one that we can go into in more detail if it's appropriate. So in the early 2010s, when it became clear that the shale gas revolution had opened up so many of these unconventional basins and was producing huge reserves of low-cost natural gas, there was this rush of interest in LNG in British Columbia, as in the Gulf Coast. And the legislature at the time, they were kind of looking at landed LNG prices in Japan, which probably about $15, $18 at the time. And they were looking at the wholesale gas value in British Columbia, which might have been a couple of dollars. And they're looking at that arbitrage and thinking, well, my goodness, there's a huge amount of profit here to be captured. So we need to make sure that's taxed. So they introduced an LNG project tax intended to make sure that there was an appropriate level of government take in terms of how those contracts would work. They also introduced a CO2 tax, which was quite a material burden on the project, which was in line with the then government policy in BC of curbing emissions. So as I say, a number of projects were envisioned, one or two of them very, very large. And gradually, many of these projects kind of fell by the wayside. They just couldn't get the right lineup of economics and environmental constraints and so forth. And so LNG Canada was kind of the last one left standing, other than these smaller ones, which were on my chart before. At the time, the Canadian federal government realized that an export route into the Pacific for their gas was essential because of the way the market in the U.S. had changed. So a demand for Canadian gas had dropped enormously just because of the sort of shale gas production that was going on. So then the federal government got involved as well. And so there was quite a high degree of collaboration between the provincial and federal government in those last months leading up to FID. And there were a couple of things which came to light and were included in the legislation. First of all, similar to what we were doing this morning, looking at the landed cost of gas and the economics and the investment required, it became abundantly clear that this was a project that was going to need help to get across the finish line. So the first thing that happened was that the LNG project tax was repealed. Then in the run-up to FID, the depreciation mechanisms were accelerated by the federal government. There was a complete deferment of sales tax on the project while it was being built. So it wasn't a tax holiday, but it was a deferment of the nominal tax for 20 years. So effectively, it's an interest-free loan for 20 years for the project to replay finally. And then the other two elements that happened, one was that the CO2 tax was also reduced quite substantially. It wasn't eliminated. But ultimately, as you can see on this slide, the final part in that kind of fiscal package was a natural gas credit, which was applied to corporate income tax, provincial corporate income tax. So that that reduced the provincial corporate income tax effectively from 12% to 9%, leaving a net 24% tax rate. So obviously, if you compare that with the corporate and, sorry, the federal and state corporate income tax here, because federal tax is allowable, it comes to 28.4% as opposed to adding the two numbers together. So you can see there that already there's a potentially more favorable tax treatment in Canada. Has to be said, of course, that the BC upstream tax and royalty mechanism is different to the one here in Alaska. So there is that difference as well. But as you consider, property tax and volumetric tax and other features which you might want to consider for this, it is worth bearing in mind that these tax concessions have been offered for Canada, and that it represents a competitive framework to consider. So I think that was my last prepared slide. Very happy to take any questions.
So on the Canadian comparison, did the Canadian government give any tax concessions?
The federal government.
Federal government.
Yes. So the two, I think the two tax concessions, and I can do a little bit more work on this, but one was the deferment of the sales tax, which was quite a few million dollars. I'm forgetting exactly what.
But that's sales tax?
It was the sales tax.
But federally?
Federal sales tax, yeah. And I think that included some element of provincial sales tax too. There was accelerated depreciation for the LNG project to essentially defer tax for that. And I think those were the two main things.
So when you look at the 15% Canadian federal CIT rate, does that represent a reduced federal tax rate?
I would have to refer back to our research, Chairman. But I think it's for this class of industrial project, I think it's a standard rate.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, when we look at the Alaska corporate income tax rate, then could it be looked at an incentive to be a subchapter S and not pay that?
Certainly. Thank you, Senator Stedman, for the question and through the chair. Obviously, tax treatment for S-corps is quite complex in the sense that notionally, at least, tax is payable at a federal level on dividends. Now, the optionality that would follow from S-corp status and not having a obligation to pay corporate income tax in Alaska, obviously that provides value to a potential investor. And it's one of the things which I imagine the legislature will look at fairly carefully in terms of the investors in the LNG project, given the tax amounts potentially collectible.
Senator Stedman.
Just for those watching at home, you know, when we're looking at this, we if the gas is sold at the wellhead or at the edge of the field, they're going to pay the upstream producers, the oil companies are going to pay the corporate income tax, royalties, severance tax, and the fourth one. And that package then will be the upstream taxes, or property taxes, the fourth one. But when we look at the midstream, which is the gas line, they pay a corporate income tax. If they're subchapter S, there is no corporate income tax, no tax in the state. And that's it, along with property tax. So I think it'd be interesting to see how they view the subchapter S as a, if they do view it as an incentive versus a, having a corporate income tax, because then our rate here would be 21 versus 24 in Canada. The numbers flip.
It's a very good observation, Senator Stedman, and through the chair. The other complicating factor, of course, in British Columbia is that personal income tax rates are considerably higher. It's used to fund healthcare, and there's a whole raft of government revenue and expenditure features which are very different to Alaska. So I would definitely caution on looking at this analysis in isolation and thinking that that's the end of the story. But certainly tax rates on the midstream in the absence of income tax and other features would appear to be relatively light in Alaska without some kind of additional property tax or volumetric tax.
And
could you repeat that? I wasn't paying attention as much as I should have.
Thank you, Senator. I was speculating that without a property tax or a volumetric tax, in the absence of these other mechanisms, that the taxation on the midstream element of the project could be relatively light for the reasons you pointed out.
So when the Canadian project was contemplated, did the tax concessions at the federal level come before the construction of the project? Was it included in the legislation that Canada had, or how, at what point was that concession made by the federal government, because they had to give that to so that BC could proceed with this project?
The timing was prior to FID. So the sort of fiscal compact and the enabling legislation for these Canadian projects was, as I say, it was in the works really from 2013 onwards, with you know, change of governments and so forth. But it was really when the federal government decided that exports of LNG into the Pacific were a kind of a national were of national importance, that they collaborated with the provincial government at a level which I think has never been seen before. So it became a kind of a three-way negotiation between the project developers, the provincial government, and the federal government. And that all came to a head in March 2018. And I would describe it as the last piece in the jigsaw, which then enabled FID to be taken in October 2018. So it was really that enabling legislation and fiscal compact that was the last piece in the jigsaw that enabled FID to happen. And I think there were one or two other concessions which were negotiated after FID, but all of this was done before the investment was committed.
And you said the project became of national importance. What were the criteria to determine that it was nationally important?
Thank you, Chairman. It's I can't quite remember the criteria, but I think it would be, you know, relatively easy to establish, and I can come back to you. But I think both for oil and for gas, you know, because the Canadian oil and gas economy had been so closely linked to that of the U.S., with the advent of first shale gas and then tight oil, both of those kind of pulled the rug from underneath the Canadian resource economy. And it was clear that exports through to the Pacific were of such national importance that the project was given this special status. Interestingly, I was reading about an LNG export project in on the east coast of Canada, which as well has this kind of special status. So it's this kind of special status given to LNG export projects federally is something that continues today.
Senator Keel, then Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulford, you talked about this set of concessions and accommodations to make the project go as the last piece of the jigsaw puzzle. I guess it's an interesting case study. Can you describe to us how much of the rest of the puzzle could they see? Did they have a class one cost estimate or a class four? Did they have information on the corporate structure or what was the governmental visibility into the details?
Thank you, Senator Keel, through the chair. So this is a project that Shell and their co-investors, but mainly Shell, Mitsubishi, KOGAS, I forget with the other equity partners, but Shell were leading that project. And you know, even Shell today, they are the biggest LNG company in the world. So, I mean, there's a huge amount of resource and experience that went behind that. So at that point, they had the design worked out. It was the whole design of the project was to be very low emissions. So they looked at particular types of turbines, you know, many details of the engineering design. They had, at the very least, class two estimates from their suppliers, which is pretty well what you need to take FID. So these wouldn't necessarily have been final costs, but they would be near final. They would have had EPC contractors lined up to build everything. As I say, they had almost all the agreements in place with the First Nations entities that they were crossing with the pipeline. So really, and then to answer your question about visibility, so British Columbia legislature, or certainly parts of it, they participated in a kind of economic modeling exercise with Shell. So within the usual sort of constraints around confidentiality, that the BC government were able to see pretty well every detail of the economics of the project before they made those concessions.
Senator Keel.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's
Senator Keel, Senator Stedman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we've discussed several times privately and then here at the table today about trying to get federal government, you know, involved in maybe an equity position like they bailed out Chrysler and General Motors and then sold their investment after companies are turned around for profit. But one of the things, Mr. Chairman, we might want to think about is this issue of the rapid depreciation of the infrastructure and the incentive that brings to the table. And as I recall, Ronald Reagan did that to the real estate markets back when he was president and lit the real estate market, turned it around, lit it on fire. That went on for about a decade. So I think it'd be helpful if Mr. Fulford could help us with what kind of accelerated cost recovery schedule change the Canadians offered up to help move the project forward. And we could maybe take that as one of the issues as a note when we, if we put something together for a congressional delegation to assist in moving this project forward. I mean, that would be a easy way to move the cash flows forward in time to make the project more attractive and not cost anybody a lot other than the federal government time value money on tax collection.
It's a very good observation, Senator Stedman, through the chair. One of the features of the DOR model, or the model hosted by DOR, I know that has you know, in the numbers presented to you at the committee, there's a number of assumptions that drive that, one of which is the depreciation model. And I think they may be using a fairly accelerated depreciation in the model. And that's something which I think would probably warrant a sensitivity to look at.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, it'd be nice to know what schedule the pipeline would be under, currently under current federal law. And then, because if we have a model that accelerates that and it's different from the federal government, mm-hmm. that it might be a distortion in our view of what can move forward and what can't. So I think we need to line that up, what's actually available through the IRS, and then is there other schedules that we could advocate for to accelerate it?
Talking about last pieces of the puzzle, in the Canadian model, did they have information on total construction costs available by British Columbia Parliament? Was that readily available to them?
Thank you, Chairman. My understanding is that there was something akin to this open book economic model. I forget exactly the terminology they applied to it. But I think typically with this sort of thing, it's a group of individuals who are allowed access to that economic model, which would have included, I think, provincial government employees and possibly elected officials. But certainly the degree of visibility that the BC government had in terms of the project economics, its costs, its returns, would have been quite significant.
And another area, when we were considering, I don't remember if it was under the Murkowski or Parnell administration, there was discussions that when you're giving up the tax structure, one-third for the federal government, one-third for local governments, and I think one-third for state governments, was that calculated in the Canadian model?
Thank you for the question, Chair. One of the differences with the Canadian model, I think one of my first slides talked about the sort of community impact aspects of these Canadian projects. And I think partly because these settlements are relatively small in comparison to some of the communities in Alaska who'd be hosting these facilities. The property tax community impacts was also very small. So the transition of funds towards local communities, boroughs, call it what you will, was relatively low. So the split was primarily between provincial and federal with very little going to local, partly because of the lack of population.
Well, I think what I was referring to was the take by the industry, but we can get into that at a later time. Are there any additional questions that members of the Finance Committee have this afternoon? Any closing comments? Mr. Fulford?
No, I think obviously it's a privilege to be here talking to the committee about a subject that matters a lot to me, so appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was very informative to me, and I'm sure to the members of the committee and to the listening audience. That concludes today's meeting. Our next meeting is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We will continue having further discussions with Mr. Fulford. Is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? Seeing none, we are adjourned.